This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. With less than 6 weeks left to go until this year's presidential elections, so many questions remain. The two major party candidates are neck and neck in polls, or slightly ahead of the other, depending on which poll you pick. A large number of Americans remain undecided, perhaps aghast that it has come down to a bombastic billionaire versus a neoliberal war hawk. Arguments abound over voting for a third-party candidate like Jill Stein, who says forget the lesser evil and fight for the greater good. In past years, elections have been seen as sucking the energy out of social movements, but this year, communities that were generally marginalized by the mainstream have shown inspiring leadership through Black Lives Matter and the No DAPL actions in spite of the space that the elections occupy. My guest is Robert Jensen, a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, author of a number of books that we featured on this show, including Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, and We Are All Apocalyptic Now, on the responsibilities of teaching, preaching, reporting, writing, and speaking out. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So how have you been treating these elections? I mean, they seem to be front and center for people who, you know, see themselves as actors politically. Social media feeds are filled with them. Facebook friends have been lost over arguments regarding third-party voting. It's all very kind of stress-inducing.
Well, it hasn't been for me, and I suspect that's because I've made fairly clear decisions over a number of years. So, you know, this one was in some ways no different. So how do I approach presidential elections? I'm not going to contend they don't matter at all, because, of course, short-term policy changes as a result of presidential elections can be incredibly important. Anybody who doubts that, remember the election of 2000, which brought us George W. Bush. Okay. So elections do matter. I'll just be personal about it. I voted for Bernie Sanders in the Texas primary, and I plan to cast a vote for Hillary Clinton without question. I do that because I think in the short term, the world will be a better place with Hillary Clinton rather than Donald Trump in the White House. I don't think that's a very difficult calculation to make. We have a dangerous sort of neo-fascist, right-wing populist, call him what you like, and I think there's a compelling argument for that. But in doing that, I don't spend a lot more time and energy than I just gave you here. I continue to think that in the midterm and the long term, the more important question is, how do we understand ourselves as human beings on this planet, come to an analysis about how power works, and begin to organize ourselves? That's the long term project of left, progressive, feminist organizing. And that goes on independent of elections. So in some sense, I think two seemingly contradictory things are true. This is the most important election in my lifetime, and this election we shouldn't spend too much time dithering about it. Make a decision and move on. I personally don't support any of the third-party options. I don't think they're viable either in electoral terms or in movement-building terms. That's the conclusion I've reached, and others will disagree, but I don't spend much more time on it than that.
So let's talk about the fact that social movements sometimes get sucked away, have their energy sucked away by elections. And, you know, thinking, of course, about the 2000 election, but even, of course, after 9/11 and then the subsequent elections, the elections of Barack Obama, both of them, but in particular, the first election this year with the primary showing of Bernie Sanders, it seemed as though that might happen. However, simultaneous to this contentious election happening that is occupying so much media space, we have these other incredible, vibrant, powerful, and inspiring movements unfolding in our midst. What lessons can you draw from that?
Well, first of all, we recognize that movements require long-term planning, organization, structure, funding. Institution building is a term we often use for that. So the inspiration that comes with these acts of resistance, which then sometimes solidify around long-term projects, is very important. And it's the institution building then that matters. You know, I have sort of anarchist leanings, but I believe in in structure and institutions. I've never seen anything accomplished without them. So it's important to capture that energy and to focus on it, but then ask, what are we doing to build to make sure that energy doesn't dissipate? The elections aren't really playing a role in that, and I think that's appropriate. I think those movements, for the most part, have not gotten focused on elections. Now, that's all said with this caveat. We're facing a particularly odd election cycle with a candidate like Donald Trump who we've never really seen. And there are certain threats that candidates like Donald Trump pose, and I don't think we should minimize those things. So, you know, life is complicated. Politics is complicated. Different people will have different energies and inclinations. And I think that's important to recognize that people can work on different things as part of an overall strategy. For instance, I don't like spending time, you know, on elections. Some of my friends do. And if friends of mine think it's very important to put their time and energy into blocking the Trump campaign, I'm not going to argue too much with them. The question is, do we have a long-term vision or not? And I think that's the real question.
Well, going back to the issue of these activist movements having blossomed this year, do you feel that the fact that they had been left out of electoral politics for so long has something to do with it? I mean, what we generally hear about when we hear about African Americans or Latino Americans or indigenous folks is how, you know, strongly or loyally they will throw their weight behind the Democratic Party and then we move on. It's almost never about concerns that they face. But in the debate on Monday, one of the three major areas that was being discussed was race and policing. Obviously, the responses from the two candidates were really not substantive, but the fact that it was even an issue that was being raised seems to be a testament to the Black Lives Matter movement that I think has rightly realized that elections are not the way to create change, and the kind of organizing they've been doing is.
Well, sure. But let's take what can be expected within mainstream electoral politics. Race is a good example. You have two candidates, Clinton and Trump, with very different approaches to the question of race. But in a sense, it's fair to say that both of them work within a white supremacist framework. And by that, I don't mean Hillary Clinton is a closet white supremacist. I mean, Hillary Clinton is not going to speak in a way that challenges the fundamental mythology of the United States. And that is fundamentally a white supremacist mythology. So we have a narrative in this country about how we, you know, have our problems of racism in the past and we're all trying to overcome them, while we don't address the fundamental question of how white supremacy is sort of baked into this system. It's in most notably in the distribution of wealth. And if you are actually against racism, if you want to combat racism, you have to ask about the distribution of wealth in a white supremacist country. Now, Hillary Clinton is no more likely to raise that than Donald Trump. So, again, two things that are seemingly contradictory are true. There's an important distinction on the question of race between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And in some ways, they're both working within the same framework. You can make that point on a number of things. Take climate change. Right? Now, Donald Trump is a climate change denier, no matter how much he tries to obscure that fact. Hillary Clinton does not deny climate change. But Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party are not committed to policies that take climate change seriously. They're not talking about a cap on carbon. They're not talking about a serious reduction in U.S. energy use. They're not talking about a basic principle of a degrowth policy or a steady state economy or any of the things that make it possible for us to deal with climate change. So in one sense, you have a very stark distinction between two candidates, a climate change denier and one who accepts the science around climate change. But you have two candidates, neither of whom is willing to talk about the strategies that are actually necessary to deal in a meaningful way with climate change. Both things are true, and we just have to be able to understand that.
Bob, I want to turn to the issue of sexism in this year's election, particularly to you who are a self-described feminist. Hillary Clinton's unpopularity is often attributed by at least mainstream feminists as being because of her gender. That the only reason that more people aren't in support of this highly qualified, experienced, presidential type woman is because she is a woman. How do you view that?
Well, first of all, let's recognize the term feminist now is defined in so many ways that it is almost without meaning, not because it's not an important term, but because there's no understood, commonly understood definition of it. So Hillary Clinton might describe herself as a feminist squarely within the liberal tradition of liberal feminism. I might describe myself as a feminist coming out of the radical feminist tradition, and there's not a lot sometimes in common. Now, is Hillary Clinton being held to a different standard? Is she attracting certain kinds of criticisms because she's a woman? I think that's undoubtedly true. It would be, I think, really bizarre to claim that sexism, male supremacy, patriarchy, these terms that describe the system, don't have an effect on this. Just as it would have been crazy, and is still crazy today, to suggest that the reaction to Barack Obama wasn't tempered by white supremacy and racism, that there weren't reactions to Barack Obama that were really rooted in that racist, white supremacist world. Of course there were. Now, does that mean any objection to Hillary Clinton means you're a misogynist? Of course not. Hillary Clinton's policies are open to debate just like anybody's. But as I listen to people talk, as I look at media, it's kind of hard not to recognize that, number one, we do live in a patriarchal society, and that across the spectrum, not only in the conservative movement, not only on the hard right wing, which is often openly misogynist or openly patriarchal, but even in liberal and progressive circles, the deeply embedded traditions around patriarchy endure. And so, you know, again, both things are true. Does that mean everybody, you know, who supported Bernie Sanders and doesn't want to vote for Hillary is a sexist? No, of course not. There's an incredible variety. But just as we are, we should not ignore the deeply racist roots of some of the objections to Barack Obama, we shouldn't ignore the deeply sexist roots in some of the objections to Hillary Clinton.
Right. And of course, the big difference between the two of them is that Clinton has a much greater record for people to judge her on her politics than Obama did. And Obama, of course, being a master orator, was really able to win over a lot of general support that she doesn't seem to be able to win over. And her record certainly doesn't help her out among the types of people who supported Bernie Sanders, at least. Where is the Republican Party in all of this, Bob? And I ask you this as a Texan. although you're in Austin, where is the Republican? It seems as though Republican Party stalwarts, the sort of leaders of the party, maybe with the exception of Ryan Priebus, are kind of absent and laying low. Is it just that the entire party is embarrassed that Trump has become the ultimate symbol of their party?
Well, I think the question of the Republican Party is not just the question of Trump. It's a question of the last decade or so, the rise of the Tea Party. You know, a number of people, for instance, Noam Chomsky, has made the point that in some sense, the Republican Party is not a traditional parliamentary party anymore. It's some other kind of entity. It's not interested in governing. It's not interested in developing a coherent philosophy that's connected to reality. It's a strange party at this point. Also, let's recognize that it's because of demographic changes. The Republican Party is now committed to a survival strategy that's based really on two things. One is suppression of voting, right? That these voting ID laws are all designed by Republicans in various states to try and suppress voter turnout. The other tactic that the Republicans use to survive is an extreme form of gerrymandering. So if you're a member of the Republican Party right now, you're part of a political formation that's committed to trying to keep the vote down and to engineer the vote in your own favor. That's not a very happy realization, but I think it's an objective assessment of the Republican Party. In Texas, I think you see a very dramatic change that's common across the country, which is the old guard Republican Party in Texas, the corporate Republicans, let's say, the people who were kind of socially conservative, but really more concerned about questions of money. They're now under challenge from the ideologically fanatical Tea Party wing and the most extreme versions of the Christian right. So in Texas, what we've seen is mainstream Republicans who were extremely right wing have been displaced by even more right wing politicians who are such ideological fanatics that it's hard to even predict their activity. The sitting lieutenant governor was defeated, for instance, by one of these right-wing Tea Party crazies. Our lieutenant governor now, Dan Patrick, a former radio talk show host, really defines the kind of craziness that can actually win high office. And so within the Republican Party, you have all these problems of a demographic shift, an ideological shift, which means that before you even get to Donald Trump and the problem of mainstream Republicans being afraid of endorsing Donald Trump, you have a party that in some sense is incoherent. Now, how long can such a party exist? I don't know. And I think that's, you know, in the realm of prediction, and I don't try to make predictions very often. But when you look at the Republican Party in Texas, it runs the state and it's an incoherent entity at the same time.
Now, Bob, you're a professor of journalism, and I want to get your assessment of media's role in this election. Of course, we have several dynamics here. One is the incredible influx of cash to the media during elections because of the Citizens United decision, and Hillary Clinton seems to be, ironically, given that Citizens United was a decision taken over a film about her, she seems to ironically be taking most advantage of that ability to spend lots of cash on advertising, raise lots of money, et cetera. Yet the media seem to be very squarely in her camp altogether, even without the ads that she's spending money on. Most of the major newspapers have come out in favor of her. And Trump is pretty uniformly reviled in most of the media. However, it seems as though any attention to Trump is, you know, it's that adage, you know, bad publicity is still publicity. The media seem to be caught in this bind that any even negative coverage that they give to Trump seems to simply fuel his support. So how do you view what's happening with the media this election?
Well, let me explain the media system to you, Sonali. We have the news media and then we have entertainment media, and they're very different, you know. Okay, so part of what's happening is this blurring of the lines between news and entertainment, which has been going on for a long, long time, of course, has now, you know, gone to new heights. And it seems as if there is no distinction anymore in lots of ways. Now, that's not just a function of Donald Trump. That's a function of media decisions over the years to increase ratings and try and maximize profit. So whenever we talk about media, we always realize that inevitably we're going to talk about decisions media have made over the years based on bottom line profit, not public service. So this test of traditional journalism that Donald Trump is presenting is leaving journalism completely rudderless in some ways. And I have no way to understand how within existing media conventions, the way traditional journalism works, there's a way to provide direction. Now, the New York Times, you know, famously last week ran a story just simply chronicling falsehoods, lies that Donald Trump has told without giving the Trump campaign a response. Right? Now, that's a break from the traditional model of, you know, balanced journalism, so to speak. As you're pointing out, it doesn't seem to have a lot of effect because Trump voters really aren't concerned about being fact-checked by the mainstream media. What's the mainstream media supposed to do in that context? Well, I am here to tell you I have no idea, which means I'm just like every other media executive. I have no idea. And the people who are pontificating about this, as far as I can tell, have not really offered anything coherent. Now, the reason isn't because Donald Trump is some, you know, once in a lifetime crazy. It's because the media system underneath it has never been coherent. The contention of mainstream news media for, you know, the better part of a century now, that it is neutral, that it has no ideological framework within it which it works. The illusion of that is now, you know, essentially hoisting the media on their own petard, as we say. So we have to not only rethink how is the media going to respond to Donald Trump, I think it's a time to rethink the media structure in general and ask the question of, how is the ideological framework of any media organization constructed? Can we at least talk about that? So there's an opening here to rethink media. Unfortunately, within the media themselves, they're still trying to find the magic bullet to deal with Donald Trump. And my own view is they're never going to find it.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights on the election with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sonali. Great to be with you.
Robert Jensen is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, author of a number of books that we featured on this show, including Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.